This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the defeat of the bailout bill and yesterday's 777-point plummet on Wall Street, the sun did rise in the east this morning, and so far at least markets have rallied to recover nearly half of those losses. But as Congress vows to get back to work, big important questions are being asked about government's role in finance and the role of free markets. Almost 30 years ago now, an important part of the Reagan Revolution was to remove the shackles of regulation and unleash free market capitalism. But after the dot-com bubble, Enron, now especially after the housing bubble and the crisis on Wall Street, some are starting to lose some faith. As many Americans lose their job, their home, and watch their retirements dwindle, is the free market to blame, and is it time to re-regulate? Shortly, we'll speak with a reporter about how we got into this mess. We'll also talk with a couple of economists who differ on markets and regulations. Later, long lines at the pump. Some commuter colleges canceled classes after the 1-2 punch of Ike and Gustav. Drivers in the Southeast still face severe gas shortages. But first, free marketeers, is your faith shaken? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is Peter Goodman, national economic correspondent for the New York Times. And Peter, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And this argument about free markets, is this in some ways the elephant in the room?
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that we've come through this extraordinary period, the last 25 years or so, where unleashing the animal instincts of the market was the justification for a whole range of initiatives, lifting restrictions that prevented investment banks from doing things that commercial banks were restricted to doing, lifting some of those lines, talking seriously about privatizing Social Security, putting formerly national companies in the hands of private enterprise, and basically just paring back the role that government has played in the economy. And now there's a sense that some of these animal instincts are maybe running feral through our streets, and there's serious talk that it's time for the regulators to step back in and play a stronger role.
And I think what we're talking about is a measure of degree. I mean, after all, I don't think markets were completely unfettered ever, and I don't think they were completely regulated either.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's an important point. There are all sorts of ways in which we haven't really had a free market, as I'm sure some of your later guests will talk about. I mean, mm-hmm. We still subsidize a lot of important commodities. The government is still involved in picking the winners in areas such as national security. There are all sorts of restrictions on flows of capital. But yes, in the margin, by degree, the guiding philosophy has been deregulation is good. Market forces can be left to sort out how money moves in this economy. And now by degree, there's a sense that the government's got to look a little more carefully at how money is moving and with what consequences.
And a big disagreement is over the risks that companies take. And free marketeers would say, well, if Lehman Brothers or AIG or Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for that matter, if they take disproportionate risks and they're wrong, they should be allowed to fail.
Well, the problem with that way of thinking, according to most economists now, is that as we're all discovering that what happens on Wall Street isn't just restricted to Wall Street. And even if you don't play the market or work on Wall Street, your life, if you're an ordinary American, is tied up to one degree or another in the decisions that are made there. And if all of a sudden credit is not available because huge banks are in danger of going out of business and other banks find their finances are intertwined and there's a reluctance to lend money, that means you can't finance home purchases, you can't buy a car, you can't send children to college, you can't get your hands on capital to expand a business, which means you can't hire people. And here we are, we've lost 600,000 jobs in this country since the beginning of the year, and we're hearing a lot of small businesses are in distress, and we all know that a lot of homeowners are in distress from taking more money out of their homes or taking on more expensive homes than they could afford, all because of what was once this very free-flowing, gusher of credit that's now pulled back.
And a lot of people, though, would say, hey, all that prosperity that we enjoyed, that was partly a result of the free market.
Well, that's right. And there's no question that there are many ways in which the market is very good at figuring out where capital ought to go. It can be very efficient, and our system has made a lot of people rich, and there has been a lot of trickle down. But the question is just how much responsibility do we want to hand the markets, and what do we make of the disaster that we now have, where we have very large Wall Street institutions whose executives have taken serious money off the table for themselves, coming to Washington saying, we need a check for $700 billion. How did we get here, and what do we do going forward is the question that a lot of people are now asking.
And some people would say, hey, the market's up 360 points so far today. That's about half of the losses yesterday. All right, a bad day on Wall Street, no doubt about that. But things are stable. Maybe we don't need a $700 billion bailout bill.
Well, there is that argument. I mean, there are people who say we've been hearing from the beginning of this debate that if we don't do this bailout, we're headed right into the abyss. And most of the people I talk to think that the risks are sufficiently large. I mean, you know, this is a puzzle that we're putting together with different data points.
And none of us have ever been here before.
This is uncharted territory. And I mean, most of the economists that I talk to seem to think, and they differ about the means and how to be fair to the taxpayer and who should ultimately foot the bill. But most people seem to think the risks are so big that we have to do something. But there is a minority view that says, well, hold on a second. Unemployment's bad. But, you know, it's about 6%. It was 25% during the Great Depression. We still have some, you know, tepid economic growth. And we've been living by this system where the markets dictate what happens for a long time. And let's let the markets play a role here in cleaning up the mess.
Yeah, we've got to take the bad with the good.
I mean, there is that view. It's there is a fundamental debate now about how much responsibility we want to give to the markets over our day-to-day lives.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with Peter Goodman, the national economics correspondent of the New York Times. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Free marketeers, is your faith shaken? Let's talk with Steve. And Steve's with us from San Jose in California.
Hi, Neil. Great show.
Thank you.
I would take what your guest is probably going to consider a pretty extreme free market view and say that, and I'm not remembering the name of the firm a little over 10 years ago that was leveraged about 30-1, where there was a government intervention that bailed the market at that point. I would submit that if that would have been allowed to work its way through the system, we wouldn't be in the position we're in now. And even going further back, the continental Illinois, and even the savings and loan bailout. If we had allowed the markets to operate where risk was valued correctly without the government's interference, we wouldn't be in this situation. And further, that we don't, you know, doing something is not in and of itself a good thing because we don't really know the results of what the action they're going to be.
So you're saying that bailout some time ago sent the wrong signal to the market that people came to believe that even if they took ridiculous risks, the government would come in and bail them out.
That's right. And further, that the government set it up by setting up Fannie and Freddie.
As quasi-governmental institutions. But the savings and loans, those monies, they was federally insured, those deposits. So the government was obliged to pay them back.
Well, and there is another interference in free market.
Aha, all right. Then I'm sure you're not thrilled with the idea floated today by both presidential candidates of increasing FDIC limits from $100,000 to $250,000. But anyway, that's what they're talking about.
Well, Neil,
Peter Goodman,
if I may. Yeah, I mean, there's an important backstory here. I mean, one can certainly argue that when the government steps in and bails anybody out, there's a possibility of what economists refer to as moral hazard, that, you know, the next guy who's about to take a reckless bet figures, well, why not? Because I'm not really playing with my own money. If it really works out terribly, I'll be bailed out. That is a serious problem, and that's a problem that policymakers take into account. But let's remember that, you know, a generation ago, a lot of people had pensions. They had defined pensions where they retired and the company agreed to pay them, you know, X number of dollars a month, regardless of what happened in the market. And more people had health insurance, and there were union jobs that regulated the conditions of people's employment. Now we live in a world where there's incredible fluctuation, and people now tend to have their retirement accounts, if they're lucky enough to have retirement accounts, in 401k plans, which fluctuate daily with the market, as a lot of people are finding out on the downside, you know, these last few weeks. So there's a lot more livelihood that's directly connected to the market than there used to be, and that's the basis for those who argue that the government has to play a role here in making sure that people are taken care of.
Steve, I'm sure you'll disagree, but I'm going to have to cut you off because I wanted to ask one last question to Peter Goodman before we have to let him go. And Peter, that is yesterday the bill failed in the House. Today we saw the leaders of the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate come out and say we're going to put bipartisan issues aside and we're going to get this done by the end of the week. Where do we go from here? Are they going to be tinkering with the same bill that lost yesterday in the House, or are we back to square one?
It seems like they're going to be tinkering. It seems like the general sense is this thing is so messy, and if we open this up and we start again, we run the risk of alienating even more votes. But I'm not really close enough to it to say that with authority. I mean, what is clear is that there's no safe ground for any of these lawmakers. And on the one hand, there's the fear that through inaction, there really is a disaster that lawmakers have to answer to, and yet there's the equal fear that, at least for those people who voted against this thing and are still on the sidelines, that they really don't want to be in a position where they're writing a big check to Wall Street at a time when ordinary people are losing their homes and losing their jobs. So there's no sideline to stand on here that's safe ground.
And again, the liberal Democrats who voted against it say, look, by doing this, we're privatizing profits and socializing losses. But the majority of the votes against it were right-wing Republicans who said, look, this is un-American. This violates these principles of free markets.
That's right. I mean, we've gone through this period where we, Americans, have been lecturing to much of the rest of the world, whether we're talking about the Chinese financial system or Latin American companies and governments, that the way to run your economy, the way to maximize prosperity is to get the state out of the way. And now we're in a position where, at a time when American banks, for instance, have been going over to China and advising Chinese financial systems on how to let the private sector rise, how to let the private sector determine where money should go, we're talking about the government stepping in and playing a very strong role in our financial system.
Peter Goodman, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Peter Goodman, the national economic correspondent for The New York Times, with us from our bureau in New York. We're talking about the troubled U.S. economy and faith in the free market. Has your faith been rattled? 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. Up next, a free marketeer and a free market critic face off, and more of your calls. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the record-setting point drop on Wall Street yesterday, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez wasted no time criticizing the U.S. This morning, he called the U.S. financial crisis a, quote, failure of free market capitalism. Chavez, of course, never a strong fan of the United States, but even in this country, some fans of the free market are starting to lose their faith. Obviously, we're talking relative terms here. Government involvement in the U.S. economy comes in degrees. Not 100% free market, but also never completely centrally planned either. At this moment, we want to hear from free marketeers in our audience. Given the litany of recent bad news, are you starting to lose some faith? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now are two men who think about these issues. We'll begin with St. Paul from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, Devin Foley. He's director of development at the Center of the American Experiment. And Devin, very nice of you to be with us today.
Neil, thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone from here in Washington, D.C. is Dean Baker, an economist and co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. And nice to have you back on the program, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for a lot for having me on.
Okay. And why don't we begin with Devin Foley in Minnesota. You've written that the cure for this problem is to free the markets. Obviously, some people disagree.
Absolutely. I would say that the notion being tossed around that there are free markets currently and that the free market is failing is utter rubbish. Point to me anywhere that there is a free market. Point to me one good that isn't somehow heavily regulated by the government. If you look at U.S. tax code, we've grown from 400 pages in 1913 to 54,000 pages in 2004. I would argue there are no free markets in America right now, and there haven't been for a very long time.
And the solution to the problem is to make them freer.
Absolutely. What you're seeing right now is actually the failure of government and markets, though regulated and in a box, if you will, taking place. People are pulling their money out of a system that they do not trust, or at least of companies and various stocks that they question as far as how well will these do and perform in the future. It's a natural thing. This is human nature working in its own way.
Dean Baker, is that your view?
Well, I'd actually surprisingly agree with Devin, at least half of this, that we're very, very far from a free market. And, you know, frankly, I don't know anyone, maybe you have an exception here with Devin, who really wants to have anything that looks like a free market. I mean, we have a situation where the government intervenes in the economy in all sorts of different ways and really permeates just about every economic act we could think of. And, you know, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. Now, I've argued that very often you've had people who've argued for free market principles really on the guise of having the government intervene to make the rich richer. And I'll just give you one example I think, you know, sort of illustrates the point. We had a reform of the bankruptcy law back, I believe it was in 2005, that imposed much tighter conditions on borrowers. And this is often presented, well, we're going to, you know, make these deadbeats pay sort of story. But if you step back for a moment, you go, what exactly was going on here? Well, you had a lot of banks, a lot of credit card companies in particular, that had extended credit unwisely and had a lot of loans that weren't getting paid back. And what they decided was, well, we're losing money. We want the government to come in and beat these people up for us so we can get more money out of them. So they signed contracts. They're supposed to be adults. They signed contracts under one set of circumstances. Turns out, well, they were making money, but didn't make as much money as they wanted. So they asked for the government to come in, change the rules, and go out and beat people up. Now, that's not free market. And I'd say that we find that in place after place after place. So I would actually agree with Devin that we don't have a free market system. What that would look like, we'd get rid of patents, when we get rid of copyrights, we'd get rid of all these forms of government intervention in the economy. I don't even know what that looks like, but I certainly agree with him that we don't have a free market now.
And let me ask you what I suspect is another point of agreement, though, for different reasons. Neither of you were very happy with the bailout bill that lost yesterday. And Devin, are you pleased that it failed?
Absolutely. I definitely would be glad that it failed. I think that giving another $700 billion into the system, it's really like giving a guy in AA bottle of Jack when he's having a bad day. You just don't do it. We are already heavily in debt as a nation, which actually Dean pointed out too, and I would agree with him. There was an extension of credit, and a lot of folks are pointing to, well, house prices are declining, and it's a result of this that we're in this mess. Well, let us ask the fundamental question of why did house prices go up so much? House prices went up for multiple reasons. For the first and the very fundamental reason is that extension of credit, which is a result of the government. The government operating under Keynesian ideas that they believe that somehow we can manage the economy, that we can either speed up the flow of money, slow it down so that we have perpetual growth. And really, that is a false notion. You cannot continue to do that without having a correction. And so that is what is playing out right now. The second issue is actually, if you look at Fannie and Freddie, they have made, in the notion of making housing, quote, affordable, you let people buy houses that couldn't necessarily already afford the house. So you get them in, which only then with easy, cheap credit, which drives house prices up further. On the flip side, if somebody can't afford a house, and I wrote this in a recent article, I mean, if you look at anything, if something's priced too high, what generally happens? It comes down in price until somebody can afford it, unless, of course, you're the government and you intervene to prop that price up, either through direct regulation, through direct subsidies, or indirect subsidies by giving them to consumers.
And Dean Baker, you wrote a piece where you said you couldn't see anything in the bill that you liked.
Yeah, I mean, we clearly have problems with the financial system, and, you know, that's part of a larger problem of a collapsing housing bubble. We've lost on the order of $4 to $5 trillion of housing wealth over the last year and a half or so, and we're probably going to lose another $3 to $4 trillion. And that's the basis of the problem. And that has also obviously created very severe stress in the financial system, and this will at best help to alleviate, and I would just say help, not very well, it's not very well spent money, to alleviate that distress. And I think the Bush administration has just been incredibly responsible in, you know, using these scare tactics, talking about the Great Depression. I've talked to people like, what exactly does that even mean? Holding up the specter of the Great Depression if we don't pass this. And today I was told I didn't actually see this, that he was jumping on the fall in the stock market as more evidence for his plan. I mean, if we're going to start doing economic policy by the ups and downs in the stock market, boy, we're really in trouble. So, you know, this was really hyped and created this fear among the elites here in Washington, because I know everyone I talked to was like, oh, my God, it didn't pass, which is just totally unwarranted with the underlying realities of the financial situation. We are in trouble, no doubt about it. But the key problem for the economy, again, is the collapse of the housing bubble. And the financial stress that we're seeing, you know, it's a problem, but, you know, it's a problem we don't have stimulus to. I mean, it's just not that big a problem. They've really misrepresented the proportions here.
Well, let's get some callers on the line. We'll begin with Brian. Brian's with us from Drexel Hill in Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi, Brian.
My major concerns are the Republican values and the basic American economic values that have been put at threat here. I'm not a Republican, but when people found out how extensively involved Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were in the home mortgage business.
70%.
Yes. That is unreal. It should never, ever, in the name of anybody, be over 15 to 18%. And why it is that high is beyond comprehension. I think that terrorized the public more than anything else, just to learn that. And the unregulated market, where's it going? Let it go. This is part of our basic American economic values. Just let it go and see what happens. This is our statement to the world that our system works.
Dean Baker, a quick
Take
reply.
Take a chance.
Well, you know, I do think we have to be concerned about the financial fallout we could have here. But in terms of Fannie and Freddie, their share rose to 70% in the last year or so, basically because the private side of that market has disappeared. So it had been lower, and it was only after the private side disappeared. Fannie and Freddie were not leaders in the subprime push, by the way. This has been a myth that's been pushed in the last, you know, few months or so. They were definitely trailers. They were losing market share in 04, 05, and 06, the height of the subprime nonsense. So to try and pin that on Fannie and Freddie, it's really misleading. Although I'm not going to defend Fannie and Freddie. They deserve their fate.
Okay. Brian, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Let's see if we can go now to George. George with us from Sheridan in Iowa.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah, I think we need to look at our history books and realize that stock market crashes and things happened long before John Maynard Keynes was even born, like in 1873. And that the world that's been created since his advice had been ignored after World War II, we've created a totally unsustainable economy where we get our food from clear over on the other side of the world, where we use fossil fuels like there's no end of it, and where we cram people into cities looking for jobs that often don't exist when they could have stayed in their rural communities. And so we need to look back at what John Maynard Keynes proposed when he said, never again can we allow an economy to crash. And he wanted to have international commodity agreements so that people in rural communities all over the world would get paid for what they produced, and people's labor would be valued, and the environment would be taken care of, instead of creating everything based on debt that eventually won't ever be repaid and will lend to end in another Great Depression, just like we saw over and over and over again through our whole history.
Devin Foley, I'll get a response from you on that.
Absolutely. I'd take note as far as Keynes saying never allow an economy to crash. That didn't really work out too well for the Soviets. The very notion that
George proposing an economy for the Soviets.
George, would you please give him a chance to talk? You've had your chance. Go ahead, Devin. I'm sorry.
The very notion, whether it's Keynes, I'm not implying that Keynes is a full-blown communist. He might have some fascist tendencies, and not in the evil Holocaust nature, but simply as a structure of government partnering with corporations and things of that nature, which I would be alert to seeing some signs of today and would be worrisome. But the notion that you can somehow control and manipulate the economy, I'd point actually to the 30s and actually Nixon, same experience. Wage and price controls, the attempt to say, well, we're going to fix things, we're going to stabilize things by blocking the market out and creating wage and price controls. It's a great play out. If you look at wage and price controls, what did they do? Businesses couldn't compete for workers because workers would actually stay put. So they instead started to offer health benefits. Well, health benefits then, the government gave a wink and a nod to the corporations, and the corporations now had a tax deduction for providing health benefits to workers. This is enshrined in the U.S. tax code and is the fundamental root of our health care problems now, where everybody's dependent upon their employer providing health care. Break the system down. We need to free the system and allow the actual consumer to be the one that's dictating what prices are and things of that nature. And that's just one example on healthcare. There are numerous examples of where government trying to run things from the top fails miserably. And, of course, the biggest sign of that is the communists. And I think if you look at the Chinese, where they are deregulating and successfully growing, they seem to have learned the lesson, as well as the South Koreans, as well as the Vietnamese, as well as any number of economies around the world.
Here's an email on that point from Philip in Cincinnati, Ohio. I visited the Soviet Union in pursuit of business opportunities in 1991. I was immediately struck by the fact that the Soviet business culture was totally different from that of most of the world. The difference was control. Every enterprise there was a state-owned monopoly. While the large banking and financial enterprises in the U.S. are not purely monopolistic, they are large enough to virtually control their own fate at the expense of their small-scale customers. Close regulation must take place of market forces in controlling the excess of enterprises large enough to do what they want and too large to fail. We're talking with two economists, Devin Foley, Director of Development for the Center of the American Experiment, and Dean Baker, who's an economist and co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Ian. Ian with us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi. One comment I'll make is we've never been able to seem to find a good middle ground between communist regulation and free market piracy. I have a couple of other comments I wanted to throw in here too, but I'd like to kind of hear what your people have to say about this.
Let's go first to Dean Baker. Well, obviously we're somewhere in that middle ground.
Yeah, and to my mind, I think that's really where the debate is, and I just think it's helpful to try to, again, Devin might be the avid free marketer here, but I think apart from a very, very small segment of the population, I think that's where the argument has to be, not based on ideology, but based on pragmatics. And, taking the point that the earlier caller had made about concentration, we see that in sector after sector after sector, and certainly we're seeing that today in the financial sector with the failure of some major banks. It looks like we're going to end up with a situation where, three banks, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Chase Morgan are probably going to control on the order of 50% of all deposits in this country. Now, that came about in some sense through the market. I mean, we could argue how much that was a market outcome, but it sure looks like it's coming about through the market. Now, are we just going to let them act without government regulation? Or are we going to say, no, you guys have enormous power. They're all too big for failure. To fail. We can't envision you're going to let a bank that size just go out of business and tell all the depositors you're out of luck. So the question in my mind is, how do you regulate them? Not whether you do, just how do you do it? And I think that's really, again, Devin may be the exception here, but I think, that really is the debate. And in principle, you want to do it with clear eyes. What's the public interest? Obviously, the banks hire their lobbyists. They have a lot of people out there pushing their case. What we need to try to do is make sure that these regulations get made in the public interest, not to suit the banker's profits.
And Ian, I know you've got more to say, but I wanted to get some more emailers in.
Okay, have a good day, sir.
And thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. This is from Nate in Des Moines, Iowa. This crisis doesn't make me lose faith in the free market. It makes me lose faith in our government's faith or dedication to the ideals of the free market. Adam Smith would slap us with an invisible hand if he could. The government's solution to everything is more government. And this from Suzanne in Portland, Oregon. I haven't lost faith in the free market because I never had any in the first place. You have to make assumptions, one of the most important one of which is that people will behave honestly, and we know that simply isn't true. People are greedy, and they will cheat, lie, and steal at any opportunity. Without laws and rules, it will be a literal jungle, and the average person in the U.S. will lose. The rich will get rich, and the poor, poorer. And Devin Foley, I wanted to give you a chance to come back on that.
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of great points and issues to talk about. As far as that last point on there will be greed and cheating and all of these things, and we need the rule of law, no free marketeer is going to really be saying that, oh, there are no laws, there are no order, it is just anarchy. It's just a false, it's a straw man argument, actually, to make against free marketeers. You need the rule of law, but you need equality under the law. You need private property rights, things of this nature. And actually, the free market presupposes and depends upon actual human nature. There is greed in the system. To try and believe or to ignore what we know is human nature, what we've seen over thousands of years of unchanging human nature, markets work simply because of greed. If you put the proper rules within the system where there is equality, where there is property rights, where there's trust within the system, great things can happen. But when you begin to over-regulate, when you actually regulate, not just have a law, but you actually regulate things or you prop certain things up. Dean made the point of, you know, well, these major banks are coming together. Well, you can't say that the government isn't picking and choosing some of the winners here. You've got Lehman, well, what happened there? Bear Stearns gets pulled out. Money is moving around. There's definitely, it is not a free market system currently picking the winners and the losers for the banking system right now. And even to the greater point, as far as these very large corporations and not having competition, let us just look to the domestic automakers. They may have had that, but competition is driving them to actually question whether or not they'll even be around.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there, but thank you both for an interesting conversation. Devin Foley, Director of Development at the Center for the American Experiment, with us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil.
And Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research with us by phone from here in Washington. Thank you, too.
Thanks a lot for having me on again, Neil.
The gas crisis coming up next on Talk of the Nation, NPR News. Lines more than an hour long, reports of fistfights at gas stations. Frustration is mounting for many drivers in the southeast. More than 2 weeks after the double wallop of Hurricanes Ike and Gustav, many in the Carolinas, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Alabama still face gas shortages that they were told would be only temporary. Refineries were forced to cut production after storms pounded the Gulf Coast. Things got worse when some people began stockpiling gas. More fuel flowed into some areas over the past couple of days, but many drivers continue to sit in long lines and pay a premium at the pump. If you're in the southeast, what's happening at the gas stations where you live? Are stations closed or reopening? Do you still see long lines? 800-989-8255. Drop us an email. That address is talk@npr.org. You can also weigh in on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now from his office is Patrick Johnson, Atlanta Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Nice to have you on the broadcast.
Hi, Neil.
And I understand when you had to get lunch today there in Atlanta, you passed five gas stations that were closed.
Yeah, there's still not much gas here, to be honest with you. We keep hearing that supplies are going to be running up and we've got tankers coming in, but there's been no change, really, in the last, I'd say, 10 days. And a lot of the people I talk to who are outside of government are pretty skeptical of promises of quick relief. They say at least two more weeks of basically, you know, changing your life around and trying to plan on, you know, what you're going to do if you can't find gas on your way to the store or wherever you're going.
Well, our memory spans are short, but it does seems a lifetime ago that Ike hit the Texas coast.
Yeah, but it hit at a bad time. The refineries were already ramping down summer fuel production. Of course, Gustav had hit, so they had shut down for that, and then Ike came very quickly behind that and hit, of course, Houston. It shut down 15, I think there's about 56 major refineries in the area, but shut 15 down. So supplies were already at a pretty, not a historic low, but supplies were, I think, at a, they hadn't been that low since 1967. And then you had these storms, so you had basically very little gasoline coming through the pipelines. And when people started noticing sacks going on the pump handles, they reacted, I don't know, reasonably or not reasonably, but they started topping up and running the pumps, and that's where you saw the long lines and the tensions at the pumps. And of course, that exacerbated the problem. But, you know, as a motorist myself, you have to wonder, you know, you do have to go places, and it's hard to criticize people too much for simply trying to make sure they've got some way to get to work.
Why is this so regionalized? I mean, don't these refineries supply fuel for the much of the country?
Well, yeah, they do. But this area, like Atlanta, Nashville, Charlotte, Asheville and Southern, I mean, this is all over, but it's basically two pipelines that come through here, and all the gas comes through here. It's the Colonial and the Plantation pipelines. So the city like Atlanta depends entirely on this pipeline, and there's no backup system. So basically, if there's no gas coming through that pipeline, there's no gas at the pump.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. Again, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk at npr.org. Our guest again, Patrick Johnson of the Christian Science Monitor. Pete's with us. Pete on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah, I think the problem is that you've got, like Colonial Pipelines, like you said, one company that's just too big, and we're depending on it too heavily, kind of like depending on AIG too heavily. And here in Charlotte, there's been lines 3 to 5 hours just this last weekend. I've seen people pumping, taking a gas can and putting gasoline into cups for people to get home. So it's just really ridiculous. Then you've got regional events like, you know, the local amusement park has their Halloween thing, the Scarewinds, and, you know, MonsterCon is next week, and different things that are, just real short term. That people are not being able to get to.
Yeah, Patrick Johnson, I assume that there's a lot more effect on businesses than just the MonsterCon that Pete is talking about. For one thing, a lot of people drive for business.
Oh, absolutely. I know in Asheville, North Carolina, I had a terrible shortage. It's getting a little bit better now, but I know pizza drivers were stranded and landscapers weren't working and a lot of people were working. Telecommuting's become very popular. Light rail here in Atlanta, MARTA, the local transportation authority, has seen rides increase by a million in the last 10 days or 2 weeks. So, it's hard to measure the impact, I think, on business and the economy, but it's major, and it's having to people changing their habits. I know there was a technical college in Asheville that closed for a couple of days today. Speaking of Charlotte, I know they have teacher work days. I think they had one yesterday and today, and they're asking teachers or telling teachers they can stay home instead of coming into school and only so. So, no classes canceled there in Charlotte, but certainly it shows the concern.
Pete, what are you doing?
Well, fortunately, I have a very short drive to work, so I'm in good shape. And I had filled up when I went to visit the in-laws in Virginia, so I came in with a full tank. So blessedly, I've not had to wait in line.
Well, good for you, Pete.
That they get the gas tanks full soon.
Thanks very much for the call. Good luck. Let's go now to Bill. Bill's with us on the line from Asheville in North Carolina.
Hello.
And, Bill, we're told the situation in Asheville a little bit better.
Well, not necessarily. We got some gas over the weekend, but the reason I was calling was there have been quite a few gas stations over here that have intentionally been gouging the price of their gas. They've been saying that they don't have fuel when they actually do in the tanks.
Really? Why would they not sell gas that they've got in the ground? They're in business to sell gas.
Yes, they are in business to sell gas, but they're also in business to make money. And as long as they say there's not as much gas as there really is, they can keep the price high. In Asheville and in surrounding areas, I've seen gas go for as high as $5 a gallon.
Patrick Johnson, you suspect there's anything to Bill's suspicions?
I don't know, but price gouging certainly is a huge concern. There's been hundreds of complaints filed in Georgia. I'm sure similar things are going on in North Carolina and Tennessee as well. So, and Alabama, too. I know the legislature there is considering a bill that would increase fines for gas stations, I think, to $5,000 if they price gouge during times like this. So that is a huge, huge concern. But the other side of that is when you talk to petroleum executives and people who oversee the system. Oftentimes, Asheville is a great example, actually, because it's kind of far removed. It's up in the mountains, obviously. It takes money to get those trucks up those hills and to those kind of far-flung places. And if there's a shortage of gas or they've got to try to spread it around, they're likely going to go where they're going to either get the best price or going to get, where there's the most people and where it's the cheapest to get the gas to. So it's definitely a weakness in the distribution system, especially to independent companies. But I think even the Shells and the Chevrons of the world are facing similar decisions. So Asheville definitely struggled a little. You have to wonder if they were able to charge a higher price if the gas would have gotten there. So, and that's something you hear from drivers too, when they're at the pump saying, at this point, I'll pay for the gas, you know, and of course other people see it differently, and price gouging is a serious matter, but it's definitely two trains of thought there.
Bill, have you had to wait in line to buy gas?
Yes, actually I have, but a very interesting thing happened to me. My brother-in-law knows a fellow who is a gas station manager, and he told him the thing to do would be go to the gas station when the gas station isn't actually open, as long as you have a station that uses the credit card reader. If you can get to one and the pumps are powered up, you could get gasoline, and that's how I managed to get gas last week. I have to come into work fairly early in the morning, so I came through, and there was a gas station that the station was closed, but the pumps were running, so I just pulled up, took the bag off of the pump, put in my ATM card, and I managed to fill my tank right up. Now, even though they said we have no gasoline, I managed to get 12 gallons.
All right. Bill, thanks very much for the call.
Uh-huh. Goodbye.
And good luck. Let's see if we can go down to Tom, and Tom's with us on the line from Atlanta.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Well, a lot of people are starting to bike around here and use mass transit, which I guess is good, but it's kind of just one more example of how the government and how a lot of private enterprises are just reactionary to a lot of the problems that happen, and they're not thinking forwards in terms of solving these problems.
Well, he's got a point there, Patrick Johnson. It does suggest that this gasoline delivery system is pretty fragile.
Right, and I think he hit on something else, too. Governor Sonny Perdue has been criticized here in Georgia for not being on top of this, and you heard a lot of government officials saying, well, there's enough gas, kind of blaming people for topping up and saying, you know, kind of panic buying was behind it. But the fact is, people were rightfully indignant and angry about it in some ways, because there did seem to be a real breakdown in the system. This was an event that seems like it could have been predicted and perhaps, if not prevented, at least ameliorated a little bit. So I think it's government officials like Sonny Perdue, who, by the way, went to Europe this week, which was another thing that made people mad, I think, because it showed perhaps a lack of understanding or lack of the understanding of the pain at the pump.
Yeah, but you had the same, by the way, Tom, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. But you had the same kind of complaints about lack of foresight when the drought was such a big issue. Of course, there's been a lot of rain last spring, so I assume that's less of an issue now. But this idea that people are not looking forward and anticipating infrastructure problems like the inability to deliver gasoline and the inability to stockpile enough water.
Well, yeah. In fact, I'm writing about that right now. But you see people. I think it's frustrating to people, and it's kind of amazing to see. You know, and some of the callers talked about it. How you kind of have to get ingenious and really mm-hmm. your behavior changes. I mean, there's been people kind of like groupies chasing tanker trucks come into the town to see which stations they're going to go to, and people.
You're talking about ambulance chasers, tanker chasers.
Yeah, exactly. And I play adult hockey, and that was, you know, we had a game last night. That was all the talk in the locker room, was how whatever schemes guys had to find a gas station and get enough. You know, some people go late at night or go early in the morning, and which strategy is the best. And it's pretty interesting.
Patrick Johnson, thanks very much for your time.
All right, Neil.
Patrick Johnson, Atlanta Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking with us from his office in Atlanta. Here's one last email from Walt in Nashville. We had a similar problem last week here in Nashville as Atlanta is experiencing now. At this point, there is much more gas available than last week. Still, several stations are completely out. Most of those with gas seem to have regular, only mid-grade and premium are quite scarce. Anyway, thanks to you all for your calls and your emails on that. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Tuesday, the day we read from your emails and blog comments. Congress is not in session today, but leaders on both sides continue to work on a plan to rescue the U.S. economy, or bail out Wall Street, depending on who you listen to. We've been talking about several different aspects of the crisis. A week ago, we focused on one oft-mentioned aspect of human nature. Greed. Could Wall Street have gotten into such trouble without the help of the rest of us? It always takes two to tango, Mark Beavers emailed from San Antonio. Over 20 years ago, during the easy credit days of the Reagan presidency, my wife and I bought a house that was, frankly, beyond our means. After paying our mortgage and bills, we were left with $20 to last the remainder of the month. Even in the good old days, $20 did not go very far. We recently moved and bought a new home. We decided to spend only one quarter of our net monthly income on our mortgage. As our lender was reviewing our application, she asked if we knew we could qualify for twice the amount of the monthly payment we'd applied for, and didn't we want to buy a more expensive house? We replied no. She asked the same question again, and we said no again. She looked at us like we were stupid. These days, we feel pretty smart. Another listener took a different view. I don't think it is greed that got the average American in trouble, but rather the American entrepreneurial spirit combined with a lack of experience. The greedy people could be defined as those who might have exaggerated their income in order to qualify for an investment property or a better home. But most of us just wanted to take advantage of a market situation in which we could earn a profit. That is what our great country is based on, after all. That email from Kim in Salt Lake City, Utah. On the opinion page yesterday, syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker explained her change of heart on Governor Sarah Palin. She was a fan at the start, but now argues that Palin should resign as John McCain's running mate for the good of the party and the good of the country. After listening to her TV interviews, Ms. Parker concluded she's clearly not ready. Many disagreed, including a listener named Cecil. She's far more ready than either candidate on the opposing ticket can legitimately claim, and certainly has more and more appropriate qualifications than her opposition can claim. Governor Palin has far more actual executive experience than Senator Obama and Senator Biden combined, and most importantly, is the only person on either ticket that actually knows, again from experience, how the vast majority of us live, work, raise children, and think in this country. She has neither the polish and lack of scruples nor the far-left mindset of both Obama and Biden, and seems tied for points with Biden when considering poorly worded or poorly chosen statements. Frankly, I trust her because she's still, more than any of the other candidates, one of us. Kara Kuhn in Carson City, Nevada, is not convinced. I think Palin has backbone and toughness and certainly patriotism, but so far as anyone out here in the general populace can tell, she doesn't seem familiar with the complex issues facing our country. Forget Obama's so-called experience. If you compare her resume to all the vice presidents we've had so far, Dan Quayle had more experience. You can hear the entire conversation with Kathleen Parker and hear other listeners' reactions on our website, npr.org/talk. And if you have comments, questions, or corrections for us, the best way to reach us is by email. The address is talk@npr.org. Please let us know where you're writing from and give us some help on how to pronounce your name.